Page 94, the Private Eye Podcast.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Page 94, this time coming to you from splendid isolation. My name is Andrew Hunter-Murray, and this week we are going to be talking about the only story anyone has been talking about for a long time. I refer, of course, to Meghan and Harry. No, not really. It's coronavirus, just like everything else. Private Eye has been covering the virus from all different angles over the last several issues, and this week we are going to present you with a roundup of the most interesting stories that we've been covering so far. We're going to be starting off with Phil Hammond, aka MD, Private Eye's medical correspondent, who has been writing reams of copy for Private Eye, all about the different aspects of the disease, how it's proceeding in this country and others. He'll be talking about the mistakes he made, as well as the things he got right, and even some reasons to be cheerful. I'll also be talking to several more of Private Eye's correspondents about how the coronavirus has impacted their own specialist areas of knowledge, things like housing, education, social media, the Street of Shame, and, of course, Europe. But first, Dr. Phil Hammond, otherwise known as MD. I started off by asking him how he's been.
I'm coming to the end of self-isolation, but still working as a doctor because I'm doing Skype consultations. So I volunteered bravely. I'm actually an associate specialist in pediatric chronic fatigue, which includes a lot of post-viral fatigue. So I'm expecting a huge spike in business further down the line. I'm 58. I have high blood pressure, but rather boldly said I'd go back to the front line. And my consultant said, "You're far too high risk. All you'll do is make the statistics worse," which I thought was very funny. But nice that some parts of the NHS are looking out for older doctors, saying, actually, it's not safe for you to be on the front line.
Right.
And some aren't. And some people, perhaps a bit heroically, are going at the age of 84 onto the front line and have sadly died, but they don't want me on the front line. But I'm doing Skype consultations, which I'm enjoying, and the kids I treat with chronic fatigue syndrome quite like technology, so they're very happy and relaxed. So maybe that's the future. You'll see your doctor with Skype.
And so you've been writing enormous proportions of Private Eye for the last few issues. Increasingly, the graph of MD and Private Eye is one of the exponential graphs I've been seeing a lot of. So when we emailed each other, before this we were saying that we might talk a bit about not exactly reasons to be cheerful, but what we've learned so far. Could you tell us a bit more about that?
It's really interesting that medicine now tries to operate on what we call a learn not blame culture. So there's been a big patient safety movement. And if you go back to the very beginnings of my writings for Private Eye in 1992, I broke the story of the Bristol heart scandal, which became then the largest public inquiry in British history. It'll soon be overtaken by the coronavirus inquiry, I'm sure. But because I didn't have any journalistic training, I broke that story very brutally and harshly. I talked about my local heart surgery unit was known as the killing fields and the departure lounge, and babies were dying and suffering brain damage, and did it in such a brutal way that the hospital drew up the drawbridge and didn't engage at all, and lots of bad stuff carried on happening. I'm getting a slight sense of this is happening with this particular outbreak. So clearly mistakes have been made, but the politicians and the advisors to the government can't admit to them because they're being eviscerated every morning on Good Morning TV or whatever. And so we're not in a situation where we're learning fast enough. And I think we need to be honest. And so I thought I'd kick off by saying I called this wrong to start with. I didn't think there would be a pandemic. I thought, a bit like SARS in 2003, we would stop it. Because that's what we managed to do back then with great global public health cooperation. And I thought, well, we've had SARS, we've had MERS, we've had swine flu, we've had bird flu, we've had Zika, we've had Ebola. Everybody has pandemic as their top global threat. Surely the first squeak of something, all these national pandemic plans will come in and we'll contain it. So I thought that would happen. So I was slightly relaxed about it to start with. And then I guess maybe around January the 30th, when the World Health Organization switched from moderate threat to international emergency, that's when we realized stuff was going to happen. And that's actually when the government really should have pulled out all the stops in terms of sourcing the protective equipment and starting the testing. So the two things they've been left behind at are their testing capacity and their protective equipment capacity. And they should really admit to that and say, I'm sorry we got that wrong. But they just can't. They keep talking nonsense, saying, we've got all the equipment, everything's fine, and we're the world leaders in this, and it's clearly nonsense. And if you lose trust, that then makes it very hard for people to follow you over the next 18 months, which is probably what we're going to need some sort of social distancing for a while yet.
Yes. It feels like the early stages still, although I think most of us haven't really adjusted to that awareness yet, that this is going to go on for quite a lot longer.
It's hard, isn't it? Very simply, you have to plot lives saved against lives lost. And there will be lives lost through the measures. And as I reported in Private Eye this week, there's evidence now that people are delaying seeking help for heart attacks, for strokes, for appendicitis, for sepsis, because that message of stay at home, save the NHS, save lives is so powerful. People are frightened to go outside and they're not even seeking help in those emergencies. And there's also the obvious indirect effects of austerity, which we know always kill people, particularly the poor. So somebody has to show us both sides of the model. They haven't even released the coronavirus side of the model. They also need to release the other side of the model that says, look, these are the potential harms, because everything is a risk-benefit analysis. In medicine, we're taught for every clinical decision you do BRAN, which is benefits, risks, alternatives, and what if we did nothing? And we need that same level of disclosure for the government to say, look, this is what we're doing. It is uncertain. And like some of the European countries are doing now, this is our exit plan. It's still, we're not sure what will happen, but this is what we're aiming to do. Let's get the schools back first. Let's start with primary schools. Let's book universities. And we just don't seem to have that level of disclosure in this country yet.
That, just to go back briefly to what you were saying about other deaths happening, not linked to COVID-19. So you quoted Professor Carol Sikora saying that 450 people die every day of cancer in the UK.
Yeah.
And there's no peak there, as it were, and the numbers are not coming down. So that number will increase unless it's got control of now. So how do you get control of that while that's happening?
By stopping scaring people. I said at the very beginning of this that the fear of coronavirus could cause as many deaths as coronavirus, and people are frightened. Hospitals are still open. You can still get treatment for your cancer. I mentioned also an eye surgeon who contacted me saying they're not seeing any detached retinas. That's that classic thing where you get a shadow, like a curtain comes across your vision and you can get floaters. If you act quickly, you can save your vision. If you don't, you'll permanently lose some of your vision. They're not seeing any. Now, I'm hoping, because there's been a bit of a push to say, actually, we are still open for business. You don't have to stay at home if you have an emergency, that will go down. But I think there probably has been some harm to cancer patients, to cardiac patients, etc. But the harder to quantify harm is recession, loss of jobs, etc. And that always hits, as I say, poor people first. But again, the climate is much nicer. The air is much clearer. There'll be less asthma. And we know that air pollution kills 7 million people globally a year. We know smoking kills 8 million people, including 1.2 million innocent bystanders who breathe in passive smoke. So it doesn't have to be an infection for there to be bystanders who are affected by your behavior. So this is just another in a line of complex man-made risks, because I think this risk is man-made. It's what we do with animals that has given it to us, that we're going to have to learn to manage, and we can't stay locked indoors forever.
Yes. Although, just to be clear, as you say, the risk is a thing that's man-made. It's not the virus. Just to be super, super clear, because we don't want to start anything. Yeah.
But it is interesting. I mean, we know that... I mean, and to be fair to the virus, it doesn't want to kill us. Viruses is, well, Peter Medawar, who's a Nobel Prize-winning immunologist, said that a virus was a bit of bad news wrapped in a protein. And that bad news either comes as RNA or DNA. But to be fair, it doesn't want to kill us. It just wants to replicate. It exists purely to replicate. And the reason it's fatal at the moment is it's jumped species. It didn't want to jump species, but probably... what we do to horseshoe bats in live animal markets seems to have allowed it to cross to humans. Sometimes it goes via another animal, where various mutations then allow it to skip again. And it's arrived in a situation that our immune system's never seen it before. So that bad message is particularly bad for us because we can't react to it. And interestingly, a lot of the deaths are because the immune system then overreacts. So sometimes younger people pick this up because their immune system, like a pot on the stove boiling over, it overreacts, releases huge numbers of cytokines and inflammatory chemicals, and that can cause as much damage as the virus itself. So it's a bit like a dirty bomb, far more unpleasant than a simple viral pneumonia. But the vast majority of us still aren't going to die from it. So it's affecting some vulnerable people. And I think the most interesting thing is that the curve for this, the mortality curve for the virus, is almost identical to the mortality curve for a normal year of death. So what we're doing is we're, if you're at the age-related risk of this virus, far more deadly in the over 80s and over 70s, is exactly the same as death from all causes. So what we're doing with this virus is we're compressing a whole year's worth of death risk into a few months. So for all of us, it's increasing our risk of death over the period of it. But for the elderly, it's far greater. And what's likely to happen is we'll have this peak of deaths, maybe 40, 50,000 extra deaths. But then in the summer, there'll be a dip in deaths, because some of the people who die would have died later in the year from other causes. So it may be when we get to the end of the year, normally we have around 600,000 deaths, there may only be 640 or 50,000, rather than the rather scary 500,000 excess deaths that was originally predicted from a model which scared everyone and scared the government and possibly made us... We went too late, and then we may now overdo it and stay in lockdown too long.
Well, that's one of the other things you write about, is what everyone is starting to think about, which is the balance of when to come out of it, what the effect is, what the economic effect will have on people's health as it if it runs longer and longer, the lockdown. So, and you're quite forthright about the choices to be made about, for example, palliation and ventilation and the choice between the two of those for some elderly patients, for example.
But we've known, and this was always the case, I got it slightly wrong in making comparisons about the flu season, because this is clearly a more unpleasant illness than flu for younger people. What's happening is the younger people who are getting it, often they have comorbidities, and the elephant in the room actually is our poor public health overall. So many younger people have diabetes, obesity, high blood pressure, etc. They tend to be more affected by this, but they really fight for breath. So it's like having high altitude sickness. They're gasping for oxygen, very close, and it's really unpleasant. And if they need ventilation, then they're unconscious, and then they either live or die, which is about 50-50. The elderly patients, because they don't have the power to fight it, are dying the kind of deaths that people normally die from flu. So then they're not hugely distressing. They're dying quite quickly and peacefully. But because they're being separated from their relatives often, then the grieving process will be much greater. So people will be dying. Their relative can't be in there holding the hand. The funeral will be there. Nobody's allowed to hug. We're going to have big, prolonged grief reactions from this, but the death itself is not that unpleasant. I think that's important to say. So I said in private eye early on, at 58, I'd still like to be in the queue for a ventilator because I've still got some puff left in me. But if we were short of ventilators, I would understand if somebody 30 or 40 years old jumped ahead of me in the queue, because that's always happened. If I was in my 80s, I wouldn't want to consider ventilation. And what we're finding is that's not an option anyway, because people are dying quickly from this, and so it's not happening. So rather ironically, we probably have got the ventilator capacity we need at the moment. We've built this huge, great hospital in London and various others. And at the peak of the infection, only 19 of the 2,000 beds were occupied.
Is that partly because you want the capacity to be surplus? Really, you don't want to be using that hospital to its full strength.
So we've gone for ages saying we've got no capacity. So, you know, let's give praise where praise is due. Well done, NHS England, the private sector, the military, getting together and building these hospitals in 2 weeks. That's an extraordinary achievement. They also cancelled loads of routine operations. They freed up the beds, and good for them. You know, they deserve a lot of credit. NHS England actually got onto this in January. They were ahead of the curve. They were ahead of the government. They were ahead of Public Health England, I think. And they come out of this with credit. But of course, you need to staff these beds. So we know we have a shortage of staff. So perhaps one of the reasons the Nightingale Hospital isn't fuller than it should be is that we don't have the staff to go with the patients who are critically ill. So they're remaining within their hospital. So it's complex, but at least we have some spare bed capacity, but we may not need it.
Just quickly, when you say NHS England did quite well in terms of cancelling routine operations, freeing up beds, this kind of thing, deserve more credit than Public Health England. Can you explain the difference between those two for listeners?
My previous only ever appearance on Question Time was in 2012 when I tried to have a pop at Andrew Lansley about his reforms, which basically was splitting up the NHS into all sorts of different structures, and nobody really knows who's in charge, everything is outsourced, etc. And I said, you know, this won't give us a joined-up service, we'll fall behind the cracks, and got very red and puce-faced and angry and haven't been invited back on since, although they keep phoning me up now, interestingly. But the point I was making is, who's in charge? We don't know at the moment. Is it the Department of Health and Matt Hancock in charge? Is it NHS England and Simon Stevens in charge in England, or is it Public Health England? The 2012 reforms created something called NHS England, which was to give the NHS a measure of political independence. Not necessarily a bad idea, but of course the Department of Health sets a remit for it every 6 months. So the Department of Health still has a degree of control over NHS England, but NHS England has a degree of operational independence. And under Simon Stevens, who's got a very big brain, he's been quite politically canny in the way he's managed that.
He's the head of NHS England.
Is in NHS England. Yeah. The Public Health England is another arm's length body which comes under the umbrella of the Department of Health, but also has a degree of operational independence, as does NICE, the National Institute of Health and Care Excellence. And it's good in a sense for them to have a degree of operational independence, but in a crisis, you absolutely need to know who's responsible for this, who is responsible for the supply chain for making sure people get the masks and gowns that they need, who's responsible for sourcing the reagents and then contacting the labs and making sure that these are delivered at the right time. And I think there's been confusion. We call it a collusion of anonymity, is the technical term, and that means there are so many people in charge, nobody's precisely sure, and they just pass the buck around each other, and nobody nails it. You can be pretty sure the politicians will blame it on the arm's length bodies and the managers, because they're very good at centralising praise and devolving blame. But ultimately, it comes back to Matt Hancock. He's got to hold his hand up. If it goes wrong, he's got to say, look, I was the health secretary. And I said in private eye, actually, it's really interesting watching, whatever happens in this pandemic, we know Jeremy Hunt will survive. So there he is. He's sitting on the Health Select Committee watching everyone else go down, and he'll rise out of the ashes and perhaps be the next health secretary. Who knows?
There, some health tips for your own survival. Try to be Jeremy Hunt. Yeah.
He is indestructible. Of course, he was in charge when we were developing our pandemic plan in 2016, so he can't get off scot-free either. I think when that fateful decision was made to cut back on community testing, which is when the big red flag went up for every public health expert, they said, I think on March the 12th, we're going to stop community testing, we're just going to do it in hospital. That made no sense to anyone, because the hallmark of getting control of an epidemic is to test, to contact trace, to isolate, to break the chain. That goes back to John Snow and cholera onwards. And we now realise they weren't following the science. It was a pragmatic political decision because they simply didn't have the testing capacity. So they slightly hoodwinked us. To pretend they were following the science is absolutely nonsense. They just didn't have the capacity. And I think the big one of the other biggest failings is you could easily predict where this was going to hit hardest. It was bound to be care homes. If you look at what happened in Italy, is that people went skiing, which skiing, interestingly, is the start of all this. But then they went home to Italy, a fairly rich area, but where two or three or sometimes four generations of the same family live in one house, a fair amount of smoking, poor air quality, but actually quite an elderly population because of the Mediterranean diet. And it just spread very, very quickly. So we knew early on the riskiest place to be with this is probably in a care home or actually locked in a cramped home. You know, if there are 12 of you all in one home self-isolating and cross generations, yeah, that's quite dangerous, as it was in Italy. So the thing I don't understand is, with their limited testing capacity, why they didn't A, prioritise NHS staff, and B, prioritise people in care homes, because that was always where the highest deaths were going to be.
And this is what you write about how Germany has done in terms of testing as many people as possible, tracing contacts.
They had luck. The luck for the Germans was, unlike Italy, it was the young fit skiers that brought it back to Germany and I think to the UK. And if we're going to blame anyone, we should blame Neil Diamond, because if you've ever been skiing, everyone in après ski gets around in the bar and sings Sweet Caroline and hugs each other. He's actually released a version of this, Sweet Caroline, where it's got the lyrics, not holding hands, not touching me, not touching you, which sounds very peculiar. So people, young fit people, all sweating from all nationalities, from China, from Russia, from Europe, all getting together, sweaty après ski. And I have friends who went skiing in December, who got symptoms sounding very similar to this. We'll never know, but some of them got bad symptoms and lost the sense of smell and taste, which sounds very like this. So this was well out of the bag before China admitted to it. But then in Germany, because the younger people got it first and they tested them and broke the chain, these were the super spreaders, young, fit people with no symptoms, spreading it round to grandma over Christmas, etc. Germany clamped down on that, whereas we didn't. And you look in one of the eyes, we wrote about patient zero, came back from skiing holiday, shared a chalet with a GP, and Public Health England weren't on it at all. And, you know, lots of spread would have happened then. So
he was getting in touch with people saying, I think I might need to be tested for this.
The reason I was a bit too overconfident is we have some of the best public health experts and epidemiologists in the world. And in fact, Adam, one of our other journalists, wrote that, you know, when people looked at our preparedness for this, not the pandemic plan of 2016, but in terms of our epidemiology and public health, the UK was ranked second in the world. Ironically, just behind America, who've made an even bigger pig's ear of it. So I thought we have these. I don't understand why we weren't onto it quickly enough. But it's quite interesting. Apart from Germany, the other countries who were onto it quickly are the ones who experienced SARS in 2003 and realized what an unpleasant infection it was, had a 10% mortality rate, the same horrible symptoms of drowning in your own lung secretions and very rapid death. And they knew very quickly that this was dangerous. So, you know, automatically they were doing temperature checks at airports, they were making people wear masks, and they were doing rapid screening and isolation. And that's proven to have reduced deaths.
We mentioned briefly earlier the difference between the different agencies running things. Has that been a problem? The difference of not knowing exactly who is in charge of the response? I mean, it's confusing to the public, but is it confusing from within the health service?
I think it is, yes. And we don't really know who's advising the government, because the government hasn't been particularly transparent in all sorts of things, not even who's advising them. I think it has been an issue, yes, because we're, you know, the danger for me, because the government are running this line about all we did was follow the science, is the poor scientists will be hung out to dry. All the people I know can't speak highly enough of Professor Chris Whitty, the CMO, A, because of his epidemiological expertise. He's dealt with stress and tragedy in his life commendably, and they say he's the right man. And I'm guessing he realised that it was over before it began, in the sense that the Chinese were late to fess up to it. So much travel had happened out of Wuhan. It was already within our population in December, January, and we weren't going to be able to stop it. So I think that call was probably right. And then pragmatically, he was told we didn't ramp up the testing in time. Now, I don't know who would have made that decision. It's a resource decision, and I don't know whether it's the government's call or Public Health England's call to get the labs making the tests and doing it. And that lack of accountability, you know, we'll come up at an inquiry, I'm sure. But, that, you know, we were behind on the curve, whereas other countries, not just Germany, but other countries nearer to the outbreak, were ramping up their testing very early on. That's also the secret of coming out of it, which is when you talk how you're going to come out of it, we have to carry on testing. So the idea of coming out of it is you need the reproduction number less than one. So basically you want each individual person to pass it on to fewer than one other person, less than one other person, then you know you've got a measure of control. Because they have the data in Germany, they got it down to 0.7, which has allowed them to open up some schools and shops. It's since gone up a bit to 0.9, so they might have to clamp down on it. It's sort of a hammer and dance, they call it. You open up for a bit and then you hammer down if you get an outbreak. We need to do that testing. It's difficult. And then to do this test properly, you have to scrape the back of the throat, get some cells off the back of the throat, and it makes you cough. Which is why they do it through a drive-through. We've had one of the first patients we had on intensive care had had five previous negative tests. Now, that could be that the test only shows that you're shedding the virus at a particular point of time, and you've typically got to get it between 3 to 5 days of the infection. So it doesn't always come back positive, even if you have the virus. Another thing is, because people are frightened of getting somebody coughing in their face, they're doing a slightly tentative test and not scraping hard enough. It may be eventually right. We do DIY testing. So people sit at home and it's unpleasant, but you learn to. I know doctors who've done their own DIY test. I know nurses who do their own cervical smears occasionally. You know, doctors are quite good at DIY. And maybe that will be the future, as we'll send these kits out to people's homes and get them to swab themselves. And that will give us more reliable data. But we can't move out of this until we have the data, until we know that our reproduction number is less than one. We can't start ending lockdown.
You mentioned you had some post-viral fatigue tips to share with any listeners who may have had this and may be feeling a bit knackered as a result of it.
I think the most important thing is don't be forced to work while you're recovering, because we're now moving into working from home. We know with post-viral fatigue, there are two big risks for post-viral fatigue. One, rather ironically, how anxious you are when you contract the virus and afterwards affects your recovery, because mind and body are inextricably linked. So the fear surrounding coronavirus might make your post-viral fatigue worse. But insufficient rest. So a lot of people, guiltily, they're working from home, they've got the virus, their battery's on about 50%. They think, oh, I better do some work. If you work too hard and push yourself too hard before you've fully recovered, makes it far more likely you're going to crash and get post-viral fatigue. Then there are the basics, your daily clangers, I call them. And the clangers, as you'll remember, sound effect, can connect, learn, be active, notice, give back, eat well, relax, sleep. We call them the daily pillars of health. Human beings are social animals. We need to feel we're part of something bigger. So connection is important. Social isolation is as bad for you as 10 to 15 cigarettes a day. So although we're physically distancing, we don't have to socially distance. We must keep connecting with people, particularly when we're ill. Don't just learn about the virus. Learn how to play the guitar, how to cook, how to name wildflowers, how to sketch. Learning a new skill when you're recovering it doesn't draw on too much energy is good. You need to do a bit of physical activity, but not too much, because with post-viral fatigue, you can get a big crash the following day if you bust your batteries. So just pottering around the garden for 5 minutes is fine. Noticing the beauty of the world around you as you do it is important. Giving back to others. Really interesting how many volunteers we've got in this crisis. And they're not just wanting to get out of the house. They're wanting to make a constructive difference. And that's really good for your mental health. And then when you're recovering, eating well is important. Eating food that's nutritious and delicious. Whole foods are best. Drink plenty of water. Relax. Some people like an app to relax on. Other people just come up with their own music or topic. But it's important to come off the screen. You know, if you're going to look at the news, it's relentlessly negative. Do it for an hour a day and then have some relaxation time. I find dogs are very mindful. Once you've walked your dog, I just stroke the dog mindfully, sit out in the garden. And then your sleep is unbelievably important for recovery. People are sleeping really badly because they're so anxious. We know that sleep deprivation is linked not just to anxiety, but to just about every physical and mental condition will be worse if you're not sleeping. So we know caffeine after midday is a bad idea. Alcohol is bad for your sleep. It really disrupts your sleep. So if you are going to drink, please do it in the mornings, is my top tip.
That's the first time I've heard that from a doctor. Yeah,
anyone
great.
From the General Medical Council listening to this, that was a joke. But there's a point about not drinking too late at night and not drinking too much because it mucks up your sleep. So those basics, the lifestyle tips, are really important. And actually, when we come out of this at the end, we'll realise that living gently on this planet requires us to slow down, to take our time, to be kind to each other, to be kind to animals. You know, I'm optimistic. People say, oh, God, it'll just go back to normal and the rich will screw the poor and whatever. But I think there will be a significant change. People will live more mindfully and gently on their planet and hopefully look after animals. Although, having said that, the live animal market in Wuhan has apparently reopened and they're slaughtering horseshoe bats. So, we're not completely learning yet.
Phil Hammond there, providing us with some reasons to be fearful, as well as the earlier reasons to be cheerful. Now, Private Eye has also been covering the coronavirus crisis and how it has affected different areas of national life in every single way since it started. I've been speaking to 5 of our hacks about how the virus has affected their particular area of expertise, and so now we will go on a whistle-stop tour of various different isolation chambers around the country as the Eye's journalists tell us what's been going on with them and with the stories they know about. So, wipe down your earphones with a refreshing lemon towelette, maybe inject some bleach into your ears just to be super safe, and here we go. We start with housing.
So my name is Rachel Clay and I edit the housing stories at Private Eye. We have been looking at a story of a homeless man who is left sleeping on buses despite having symptoms of COVID-19 and despite both him and a charity repeatedly alerting outreach workers and a local authority to his situation. Therefore, you know, he was at risk and public health put at risk, and you don't want poorly people circulating on buses right now.
Right. Where was this?
This was in East London. Now, the context of this is that a long time ago, about just over a month ago, in fact, the government had a target to end rough sleeping, and it was by the end of the Parliament. Then on 26th of March, that changed. The homelessness minister, Luke Hall, sent out a letter to every local authority in the country saying that the target had changed and instead they were going to have to end rough sleeping by the end of the week.
Wow.
Okay, so that meant they had to prioritise people with COVID symptoms. And there was also something very important in the letter. Not only did they have to bring everyone in, so every rough sleeper, but they also had to bring in people even where they had a condition which is known as no recourse to public funds. So that would include migrants who've got permission to stay in the UK, who can work to support themselves, they can't, if they get into trouble, access help with housing or apply for benefits. And it would include as well people with a failed asylum claim, anybody who has no recourse to public funds.
And so these are people who are currently homeless, but they are unable to claim these benefits for various reasons of their status.
Yeah. So in early April, a charity that works with migrants in London, in East London, called the Hackney Migrant Centre, they got a call from a man who had been sleeping on friends' sofas. So he wasn't a rough sleeper at that time. He just had an insecure housing situation, which is very common. But no one was willing to put him up anymore. So he'd spent the past 2 weeks sleeping on buses. And this man had now developed a high fever and a persistent cough. He was a migrant with a failed asylum case, so he had no recourse to public funds. But obviously, it was an emergency to get this man accommodated. He needed to self-isolate and he needed to get better. He had already phoned Streetlink, which puts rough sleepers in touch with outreach groups, but no one was getting back to him. Quite possibly they were overwhelmed. The Hackney Migrant Centre contacted Tower Hamlets, which is a council in East London, and were told that he would be helped. But when Hackney Migrant Centre spoke to the man later, they got a different story. Apparently, he'd been told that they couldn't help him because he had no recourse to public funds. They then phoned Tower Hamlets again and again, but they couldn't get through. So they tried Streetlink again. This time, an outreach worker did make contact with the man, but they said they had nowhere to put him because their places for people who had symptoms of COVID were all full up. And apparently he was told to stay where he was for now until they could find him a place. Well, where he was sleeping on the buses. At that point, Hackney Migrant Centre tweeted about the case and it was picked up by Apsana Begum, the MP for Poplar and Limehouse in East London. And lo and behold, she did manage to get through to Tower Hamlets and get someone to pick up the phone. And this time they did find him emergency accommodation.
And that's where, as far as we know, this man is at the moment.
Yes, initially it was for two nights only and he was supposed to leave after two nights, but they were able to sort it out and make it longer term in the end. The problem was that he was only getting provided breakfast at the hotel, and so obviously it's not sort of set up to support him. One of the things the minister said in his letter was that councils needed to supply the basic necessities of food so that people can self-isolate, and this man wasn't getting that. Hackney Migrant Centre has been fundraising to get money together so it can step in and is now sending the guy food. So he did spend a very hungry weekend at this hotel before Hackney Migrant Centre caught up with him on the Monday, realised the poor guy was starving and sent in some grub.
This must not be the only case like it. Is the problem that people are falling in between charities, councils, other bodies which should be stepping in, and that these places simply can't cope with the demand?
We can't get a sense of the scale, but it's certainly not an isolated one. The system isn't designed to help them, is the truth. But we have a public, you know, health crisis where everybody has to be helped now. So there is no system. What people who work with migrants want to see is NRPF, that no recourse to public funds, suspended, because that would take a lot of the pressure off local authorities. What charity workers are saying to us is that rough sleepers are getting accommodated. You know, local councils are doing their best and they are supplying that accommodation. On the whole, although there are problems for people accessing it still. But it's much more difficult. They are still doing what they do in normal times, which is to gatekeep. So if somebody's got a condition like no recourse to public funds, they're telling them they can't be helped, even though that's not the case. They should be helping them. The minister's letter also said, in the longer term, it will, of course, be necessary to identify step-down arrangements for the future, including the reopening of shelter-type accommodation. So, in other words, we might be bringing everyone in for now. That was the phrase, you know, this bringing everyone in, accommodating everyone, but don't get too cosy. Chuck-out time will come.
I'm Ben Fox, the Brussels Sprouts columnist, and over the last few weeks I've been following the curious story of the government's decision and non-decision on whether or not to join the EU's joint procurement scheme on the bulk purchase of PPE equipment.
Yes, and this is a story that people have seen, I'm sure, lots of contradictory versions of events on. But the effective thing is that there is an EU scheme where EU nations have been clubbing together to buy personal protective equipment. Britain has not joined that, and there is now an enormous row, given our shortages of equipment, about whose fault this is.
Well, yeah, so originally this story broke, and it was quite bizarre at the time when it broke in middle of March. It was first questioned and said, why have you not been part of this pan-EU tender, which has 25 member states signing up to? And their initial reaction was to say, oh, well, we left the EU 6 weeks ago, so we're ineligible. The trouble is that was it's a completely spurious argument, because under the transition period until the end of this year, there's no reason why we can't be part of this procurement scheme. And the government backtracked on this within a few hours and said, well, actually, we didn't mean that. What we really meant was we just decided that we can do this. We can get this equipment sourced domestically and on the international market. And over subsequent weeks, we've kind of seen that that wasn't true. You know, we've seen these huge delays and difficulties getting PPE equipment. This has been a daily source of grief for ministers at the Downing Street press conferences.
Yes, and this is to do with, is it Simon McDonald?
Yeah, well, Sir Simon McDonald. there's the head of the Foreign Office. It departed from the Sir Humphrey Appleby Code. I suppose this highlights the dangers of Zoom conference meetings. But he told MPs on the Foreign Affairs Committee by video link that ministers were basically fully briefed on this procurement scheme, that it wasn't a question of them having missed any deadlines or lost any emails, which was what officials had said a month ago. But in fact, it was a cold political decision not to be part of this scheme. And then, of course, as we know, within a few hours, he then completely backtracked again himself.
He remembered, he recalled, didn't he, that actually it was nothing of the sort, completely different.
No, he had a Road to Damascus experience, perhaps prompted by Dominic Raab and Matt Hancock reading him the Riot Act. But he then sent this very bizarre letter to Tom Tugendhat, the committee chairman, saying that he had inadvertently misspoken. No such political decision was made, although, again, he did leave himself some wiggle room, because he didn't say that ministers hadn't been briefed. He just said that they hadn't been briefed by the UK mission in Brussels. A proper civil servant's answer. And the whole logic of this joint procurement scheme, as the government has found out, is that every government in the world wants this equipment. It is not a buyer's market, and which Dominic Raab admitted last week. And basically, by clubbing together and buying 1.5 billion euros worth of kit, the EU makes itself a more attractive market and a more attractive buyer. And in the meantime, NHS England are scrabbling about to procure this equipment. We have doctors and nurses without vital equipment and risking their lives.
Well, and there's one final strangeness to this story, which you wrote about, which is about the treaty governing future relations with the EU.
It's too bizarre, frankly. I mean, the irony is that the Johnson government obviously seems to believe that joint EU procurement is either pointless or is for some reason politically toxic. I don't understand that logic myself. But despite this, it still wants to include joint procurement of medical devices and equipment in the treaty that will govern future EU-UK relations. I mean, the draft treaty that has been discussed by David Frost and Michel Barnier over the last few weeks does specifically include a section on health security cooperation that would basically put joint procurement schemes in a future UK-EU treaty. So it's kind of bizarre that the government is actively lobbying for this to be part of a future treaty when we're in the middle of this horrendous pandemic and it's choosing to stay out for what appears political reasons.
So it wants the right to do this in future, despite the fact it hasn't actually done this now when it would have been useful.
If there's logic in that, I don't see it.
I'm Jane McKenzie. I'm a reporter for the In the Back section of Private Eye normally, and I'm currently writing stories about education in the time of coronavirus.
Jane, you have a story about education and about video lecturing, if you like, in this week's issue of the Mag. Can you tell us a bit more about it?
That's right. So obviously, as students have dispersed to the corners of the globe, they still are trying to continue their studies in the same way that we are currently talking over the internet to each other. Lecturers have been asked to get online and talk with their students and carry on teaching their courses. There are some risks to doing this. The first one is the risk from their own employers, who are, in some cases, seeing this as possibly a permanent way to reduce the cost of teaching at universities. There was a proposal from Durham University last week that thought maybe it could cut face-to-face teaching by 25% next year using online teaching methods ongoing once this whole situation is over.
Oh, wow.
Yes, they have backtracked from this after absolute outrage from the academics there, and indeed from students and prospective students who, you know, one of the big reasons to go to university is to receive education from experts in the field rather than a spreadsheet that they're sent with some information in.
And is one of the ways that you would save money, I guess, it's not quite saving on staff room tea and biscuit costs, is it? Is it that you're able to hire fewer people? Is it that you're outsourcing?
If you're under the impression that the information that's taught on a course never changes, you might think that it's possible to record the lectures 1 year and then just replay that every year going forwards. Now, obviously, that would actually very quickly become out-of-date information. You can't just use 5 years ago's science lectures to, you know, things have moved on. But I think earlier this year, the academics were on strike at a lot of universities, and there was a concern there that where things had been recorded, and things are often recorded, it's for, you know, if students are away ill, that kind of thing, they can be provided with material that's been recorded for them. There was concern that all that material could be used during that 6 week strike period to undermine the strike and just, well, never mind, you can watch last year's material. So there are risks to lecturers, to job security from putting everything online. I suppose there's also a feeling that, well, you know, the lecturer in Reading could lecture to the whole country rather than just the students in Reading. You know, if you lecture on the internet, you don't only have to lecture to the students who are present at your university.
So the prospect is kind of like syndicating a radio show,
yeah,
except that the lecturers don't want to be syndicated and they're also not going to be paid for it.
Yes, that's
right.
Very close to what the big worry is, yes.
And the other thing you mentioned is about is a slightly more sinister risk of how filmed material during a shutdown might be used. You said by hate groups in
your
piece. Yes,
we've not seen much of this in the UK yet, but it's already sort of been kicking off in the US, and unfortunately these things tend to trickle in our direction, is that obviously with time on their hands, though they possibly have more time on their hands normally, there are hate groups who are trawling through the materials lecturers are putting online in order to find people to troll. You know, so if people who are lecturing in maybe economics or eugenics, things like that. So just by becoming more accessible online, academics are at more risk. And unfortunately, the universities are pushing very hard and fast for the material to get online without very much advice on how to handle the side effects of that.
Gosh, do we know what comes next? Is there a concerted attempt by academics to push back against this?
I think there's a lot of willingness by academics to do what's needed because they want to provide their students with the education they were hoping to provide them with before. But there are also plenty of people highlighting the risks and talking about, you know, how do we do better than just putting videos up on YouTube that everybody can see? We want to, you know, still be having a secure and cyber-sensible approach to how we interact with students while we can't be close to them. The other thing to mention is that a huge number of academics, particularly in the further education sector, but also thousands of people in the higher education sector, are effectively on 0 hours or very limited contracts. So there are people who are very worried. They're not necessarily sure that furlough schemes apply to everybody, and their employers have been very vague about what they're being paid for and what this next term. You know, if you were previously being paid to do 2 hours of teaching a week, what are you going to be paid for going forwards? So there is a lot of worry in the whole of academia about what the employment situation is at the moment.
Hi, my name is Matt Muir, and I contribute to Anti-Social Media and generally write for The Eye about all the reasons why technology and social media companies are fundamentally awful for the future of civilization and humanity.
Matt, apparently I read from you and colleagues in The Eye that this has been quite a good crisis for various social media companies.
Yeah, I mean, it feels somewhat weird to talk about anyone benefiting from literally tens of thousands of people dying globally. And yet here we are. It turns out that, those readers with memories that stretch back before, like a month and a half ago when everyone started getting sick and our lives were changed forever, may well recall that people were starting to get a little bit iffy about social media companies and the use they made of our data and the fact that they were constantly listening to us with their domestic surveillance devices and tracking our movements. And yet it turns out that all it takes is 4 to 6 weeks of lockdown and we literally don't care about these things anymore. It's been instructive watching the extent to which the social media companies have all, yeah, as you say, done incredibly well out of this. I mean, the caveat is that they will all claim, as they have done a lot of their official communications recently, that advertising revenue is down, as it is for the ad industry all over the world, and that is 100% true. People are buying fewer adverts. And Facebook has been sort of making a big play about this, and despite the fact that we're losing money, we're doing all these great things. And so Facebook's been really interesting, actually, in some of the steps it's taken to help inverted commas coronavirus victims and the wider world. It's given grants to small businesses. It's dedicated several tens of millions of dollars that are available for small businesses around the world to apply for. It's been using data that it collects on people to help track the spread of viruses across national borders and indeed within countries. And it's also been giving free devices to NHS workers. It recently gave over 2,000 of its domestic surveillance device called the Portal to NHS and frontline workers to help them stay connected and things like that. So, you know, doing loads of really good things, and all this while still losing ad revenue. And yet it sort of behooves us all to remember that while it's doing this, the devices that it's giving to NHS staff, I don't know if any of your listeners will remember previous Eye reports about this, but it's fairly renowned as being one of the leakiest in terms of data security and privacy. And as with all the rest of them, it does record everything. And one does sort of wonder, what is Facebook getting out of knowing exactly how nurses and care workers use their personal surveillance devices to communicate at times of high stress and having that data at their fingertips? Facebook's also launched a new product for couples to help people sort of stay in touch with each other and to sort of help individuals maintain these close personal relationships. The thing that's in the small print of that, of course, is that all of the information that couples share on it that is very particular to their relationship will be shared with advertisers, just like data from all other aspects of Facebook. So it's hoovering up more of this stuff. As people are using WhatsApp more and more, as again owned by Facebook, more and more data is coming into the ecosystem. Fundamentally speaking, whilst they might be losing advertising revenue right now, you can absolutely bet that the amount of data that they're getting their hands on that they can then subsequently monetize to advertisers later on in the future is probably going to cover that shortfall to a not insignificant degree.
And the other angle of all this is about content moderation, because there are armies of people around the world who are moderating what appears on these sites and trying to keep unpleasantness off it. But these people have now been sent home.
Yeah, it's a tricky one. This, I mean, I don't know whether you have any friends or elderly relatives who've been waxing lyrical on Facebook or elsewhere about the perils of 5G antenna, Andy. But I'm sure many listeners will have seen. I hesitate to call them conspiracy theories. It suggests there's a conspiracy and that there's someone theorising behind all of this, which may not be true. But lots of people have seen these slightly fanciful rumours going around. And as with all instances of misinformation on social media, it's generally a game of whack-a-mole for the providers. And as we've reported previously in The Eye, one of the ways that they try and deal with this is by paying lots and lots and lots of people in the developing world less than minimum wage to look at a lot of horrific things on the internet and try and remove them before they spread too far. Now, unfortunately, as a result of everybody not being able to work from offices anymore, large swathes of these workers have either been furloughed or have been sent home to work from home. And for a variety of technical reasons, it's simply not possible for them to undertake the same degree of content moderation across the board as they would otherwise be able to, which means that a lot of this stuff is now being effectively offloaded onto AI systems. AI systems, which Facebook itself said at the tail end of last year, and as has been ratified by third-party assessors, simply isn't quite up to it at the moment. One of the big problems with AI is that it's not very sophisticated, doesn't understand nuance in most cases, and so its ability to distinguish between a well-meaning comment and a wild conspiracy theory, or indeed to tell a wild conspiracy theory, is pretty limited, which means that, basically speaking, there has never been a better time to attempt to disseminate misinformation on Facebook. If any listeners are paying attention to this and do fancy spreading some vile, vile lies, 5G is probably, they're keeping track on it, but anything else is probably fair game. So see what you can make up and see how far it goes. I don't mean that, by the way. We might have to caveat that with...
No, you've said it now.
My name's Adam McQueen, and I write for the Street of Shame and Media News pages in Private Eye.
Adam, tell me all about John Witherow.
Well, this was slightly amazing. There's this bizarre thing at the moment when you're working on Street of Shame. We've always had a thing where you meet up with journalists from certain newsrooms and you say to them, so go on, what's the gossip from your place? What's been happening? And quite often they say, we don't know. We find out everything from Private Eye. But that's happening even more at the moment because newsrooms effectively don't exist. Most people are working from home. So you're not kind of getting the full-on editorial meltdowns and things that everyone witnesses and then rushes to the phone or to their secret email accounts to tell us about. But one thing that did come through sort of loud and clear was this amazing memo which John Witherow, editor of The Times, that great paper of record, sent round to all staff. And when it first arrived, the first copy I saw of it, I thought, this cannot possibly be true. This must be fake. And then another one arrived. And then a colleague of mine, a chap called Andy Murray, I don't know whether you know him, he also received a copy of it. An all-staff message to everyone at the time saying some useful tips on dodging the virus, advising people to take sips of warm water every 20 minutes because it keeps your mouth moist and washes away any of the virus that's entered your mouth, to gargle with an antiseptic in warm water and vinegar or salt or lemon. It was the exact same nonsensical thing that had done the rounds, everyone's mad aunt on WhatsApp the week before. And it was just extraordinary. And the swiftest look at the Times' own archive, they had dismissed those very claims as nonsense about a week before, and advised people to ignore any messages they got on social media saying so. So that was quite a spectacular one.
But it's not all useful information that we've been disseminating. I think we should point out we've had some great fun snark as well. And that is where I wanted to bring in Amanda Platel.
Oh, Amanda Platel.
Your close personal friend.
Oh, yeah, we're on each other's Christmas cards list, definitely.
Well, I'm not sure if you will be any longer after this. Yeah, it was. This was one of your stories from last issue.
The fictional Private Eye columnist Glenda Slagg was originally created in the early 70s to parody long-forgotten figures from long before you were born. People like Jean Rooke and Marge Proops, and then later on Linda Lee Potter. But Glenda Slagg's thing is that she will say one thing in one paragraph and an entirely opposite thing in the next paragraph. And that style of journalism has sort of fallen away a bit in recent years, but then suddenly it's back in full effect with Amanda Platel. Who managed to go within the space of 4 weeks in her Saturday column in the Daily Mail from saying she refused to be shamed for stockpiling stuff, boasting about having spent £527 on a home delivery from Tesco in which she had 27 loo rolls and 24 cans of baked beans, and said, it's going to be me that's having the last laugh. To 2 weeks later saying, who are these appalling people who are stripping the shelves so that our hero NHS workers can't get anything when they come off shift and go to the supermarket? And you sort of thought, well, that was good enough anyway. But then on the day before we went to press, she was back again, unbelievably, denouncing her neighbour for stockpiling loo rolls, the very, very thing that she had been boasting about just a few weeks before. So, yeah, no, that was straight in. It was slightly unbelievable. It was one of those ones where you have to go back and actually read everything three times to make sure you haven't missed something and that they actually, someone is actually being quite as blatant as they appear to be.
Lots of newsrooms are closed now, and as you say, it's harder to get gossip. Are you concerned?
No, not so far. I mean, the other thing that we do in Street of Shame is simple dissection of stuff that we haven't heard on the hush hush. It's just actually been published in newspapers and is still nonsensical and appalling. So this most recent issue, I did a large hack watch on. Well, we called it All Hail the Dear Leader. It was that moment when Boris Johnson went into hospital and suddenly our press, or certainly the right-wing press, suddenly just turned into the Pyongyang Daily. It was just absolutely extraordinary. I wonder if actually now that he's okay and out of intensive care and recuperating, people like Alison Pearson are slightly embarrassed about the stuff they wrote about. Actually, I'm saying, I mean, when I said that, I realised what a ridiculous thing to say. Alison Pearson is utterly unembarrassable. But how is Boris? For millions of people, that was our first thought upon waking yesterday and our last thought before we fell asleep the night before. It's rare for a politician to inspire such emotion, but Boris is loved, really loved, in a way that the metropolitan media class has never begun to understand. That will be Alison Pearson, professional journalist for the last 30 years, married to the film critic of The New Yorker, and in no way, of course, a representative of the metropolitan media class. But it was the next bit that was just absolutely straight from the Kim Il-sung playbook. Make no mistake, the health of Boris Johnson is the health of the body politic and, by extension, the health of the nation itself. His health is our health. If he can defeat coronavirus, then so can we. A lot of people, even this far into this, don't seem to understand how viruses work.
Adam McQueen there. My thanks to him and to all our contributors today, Jane McKenzie, Rachel Clay, Matt Muir, Ben Fox, and, of course, Phil Hammond. We will be back again next month with another podcast, maybe from isolation chambers, maybe not. There's no way of telling at the moment. Until then, we hope you remain well. If you'd like to hear more about any of the stories we've been discussing today, and literally dozens more fascinating stories about how Britain works in the time of coronavirus, you can get a subscription to Private Eye magazine by going to private-eye.co.uk and following the button which reads subscribe. That's it for this time. Thank you very much again for listening. Goodbye.